This podcast is brought to you by Greystone Theological Institute. Faithful theological wisdom, edification, and training in a rapidly changing world. Visit greystoneinstitute.org. Welcome to Mortification of Spin, a casual conversation about things that count, with Carl Truman and Todd Pruitt. Mortification of Spin is a weekly podcast from the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. Let's join this week's conversation.
Welcome to Mortification of Spin. My name's Carl Truman, professor at Grove City College, and recently appointed, just to blow my own trumpet, as a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in DC, and canceled by YouTube. It's been a busy couple of weeks for me. So,
yeah, Carl, I was going to congratulate you on that cancellation from YouTube. You know that you've arrived. I mean, in a way, it was inevitable, but now finally, you have something worth boasting about.
I was worried I was doing something wrong because nobody seemed to be banning me from any platform. So it was kind of reassuring to finally make it.
Of course.
I now have Instagram and YouTube to my credit. Ryan Anderson only has Amazon, as far as I know. So yeah, on sheer numbers, I'm 2-1 ahead.
It's good. I mean, it's kind of impressive. And I will also say, in case some of our listeners don't know, you've actually made the Wall Street Journal now. Carl, you've arrived. Carl, you are as American now, pretty much as anybody can be American. You've been written up in the Wall Street Journal. You've been banned by YouTube. You're a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. I mean, what more do we need to do for you?
I've done it all. I think I can now happily retire, much to the delight, no doubt, of the people at YouTube.
And,
And on the Wall Street Journal as well. I mean, it's I was written up in the Wall Street Journal, not for insider trading. And that's quite a remarkable achievement. That makes you a rare person.
I agree.
Indeed.
I agree.
So, yeah. Anyway, that was the voice of my colleague, Todd Pruitt, that I had not introduced at the start there, but familiar, no doubt, to many of you. Todd is the pastor of Covenant Presbyterian Church in Harrisonburg, Virginia, in the beautiful Shenandoah Valley. So it's good to be with you all today. Mm. And we want to talk today about the issue of patriotism. Is patriotism a virtue? Is it appropriate for Christians to be patriotic? What is the distinction between nationalism and patriotism? We hear an awful lot in the news these days about Christian nationalism, which is portrayed very much as a bad thing and seems to have become something of a catch-all category for anybody who expresses any kind of pride in their country or any sort of delight in being of a particular nationality. So, Todd, what do you think? Patriotism, good thing, bad thing, something that Christians should not be involved with? If it is, how does it fit into the broader vision of the Christian life?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great question, and it's something that's causing a lot of confusion among the church. You mentioned Christian nationalism earlier, which, as you said, has become almost kind of a catchphrase, a condemnation. You know, Christian nationalism, that is now the new boogeyman in a lot of the contemporary church today. I mean, forget about all the sins that the Bible actually mentions. Now what we really have to worry about is that dastardly abomination, Christian nationalism. Now, certainly, I would imagine there's a brand of nationalism that can become sinful, just like almost anything that might not be sinful in and of itself, we can make sinful for sure. And certainly there's a kind of pride of place that can become sinful without any question about that. But to condemn or to have antipathy towards all expressions of patriotism seems to me to be a bit misguided and not necessarily grounded in scripture. I don't know that we have any admonitions in scripture to, you know, be ye patriotic. However, I think one can make the argument that citizens from Scripture, that citizens have a duty, if you like, to be thankful for their place of origin and their place in the world. We know that God and his sovereignty from Paul's speech in Athens places us individuals and nations across the face of the earth wherever he pleases. We are commanded to show proper respect to our governing authorities. Governing authorities are to love the people of their nation and to take care of them and to guard their safety, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to me you can extrapolate from certain passages that that there is a place for a proper expression of both gratitude and thankfulness and perhaps even a kind of a love for your place in the world, for the people who are most closely connected to you geographically, because you have a higher responsibility to them, biblically speaking, to those that are with you. You know, our first responsibility are our closest neighbors. And so I think broadly speaking, you can extrapolate from Scripture that there is a proper kind of patriotism, a love for one's people, a love for one's nation, that is a good thing. And, you know, I think about John's vision in the book of Revelation about the kings of the nations coming before the throne of the Lamb and giving him honor. Now, I'm not sure exactly what to make of that. I know what some people have made of that reference to the kings of the nations, that there will be in heaven all of the nationalities preserved. I'm not convinced of that, but it's interesting to think through how there is some sort of, at least in a moment where the kings of the nations are coming before the Lamb and laying down their crowns, some sort of a recognizable nationality. I don't know to what extent that's preserved in heaven. I don't think we're going to have separations of you know, different classes of heaven and different nations in the new creation like we do now. But I say all that to say there is something God made and potentially God honoring about these national distinctions of ours. I'm not talking about racial distinctions, but and that's not what the Bible is concerned about. You know, these kind of racial distinctions as we understand them in our contemporary moment, but national distinctions. God created that. It's a capitulation to the fall, I think. But nevertheless, there is something that is good and necessary about national distinctions. And Americans can be thankful to be American, and a Canadian, although I don't know why he would be, can be thankful for being a Canadian. And so forth and so on.
Sandy Finlayson will be sending in a letter of complaint, I'm sure, after that last comment. Yeah. I mean, a couple of things come to my mind. One, of course, is that I think there's a legitimate fear that nationalism, a kind of national chauvinistic attitude, yes, to one's own identity, to the denigration of other people,
yes,
is a very worldly mentality. And one would agree, but I think one must also bear in mind that collapse of nationalism, or collapse of patriotism even, can also be very worldly. Again, listeners will know one of my intellectual heroes is Philip Reeve and his analysis of the rise of the therapeutic society, a society focused upon the emotional needs of individuals. And he makes the comment in his book, The Triumph of the Therapeutic, that as the sort of the therapeutic, we might say, selfish individual emerges as normative in society, two institutions will be marginalized. One of those institutions is the church. The other institution is the nation. And he says the reason for this is that church and nation require a sacrifice of self.
Yeah.
So in the reaction we're seeing, I would say, not just against extreme forms of nationalism, but against patriotism, we're also seeing, you know, the rise of a very worldly mentality, if you like. It may not be fear of nationalism that drives some of this. It might actually be the exaltation of self, of therapeutic needs, that drives it. And the second thing I'd comment on is there's a rightful fear, I think, that if we have pride in our nation, we automatically look down on other nations. And I mean, yeah. You've given a great example of that. You already indicated that that your love for America leads you to sneer at Canadians. Well, I'd want to suggest that patriotism doesn't need to be a zero-sum game like that.
Yeah.
And I draw analogy with, say, my wife. I think my wife is the most wonderful and the most beautiful woman in the entire world. And when I say that, people hear me as saying, I love my wife. They don't hear me as saying, every other woman in the world is mediocre and inferior to my wife. A man's love for his wife, a wife's love for a husband, that's not a zero-sum game. Mm. It's something that speaks very personally. And I would say the key to legitimate patriotism is that pride, that gratitude in the country from which one comes, which does not lead one to look down or to despise or to spit upon other nations and other countries. I mean, I'm not an American citizen yet. I'm a citizen of the United Kingdom. Even if I ever take out American citizenship, my heart will always be English. Sure. You know, home and the, is where the heart is to some extent. But I'm incredibly grateful that I'm allowed to live in America. America's been very kind to me and my family. I think there is tremendous amount to appreciate in America. Not your heads of state, I have to say. No, there's nothing to make one a monarchist more than living in the United States of America.
Our batting average is not great right now.
Yeah, I mean, okay, the next generation could be problematic for us. But, you know, I came over thinking, is the Queen a good idea about it? I don't know. Yeah, after the last 20 years of American presidents, I'm inclined to think, hey, Queen's not too bad. I don't have to worry every 4 years that there's going to be an embarrassing person running my country. Right.
You know, Karen and I, my wife and I went to Scotland 2 years ago and had a wonderful time in Scotland.
So close to the promised land and yet so far away, man. You it must have been frustrating. You could almost taste
What was great is that the whole time we were in Scotland, I never felt an urge to hop on a train and go south. I mean, I felt very much at home.
You're not sanctified enough. Clearly, there's stuff to be mortified here, right, man.
But here's the deal. I would have been disappointed had I gone to Scotland and not seen Scottish people love Scotland. It would have seemed strange and really, in a sense, wrong had I gone there and not seen any Scottish flags, not seen any banners with a thistle on it or anything like that. That would have been very, very odd. You know, when we did some of the castle tours, you know, that tourists have to do at Edinburgh and Stirling, which were wonderful, by the way, you know, the tour guides were clearly filled with a sense of great love for their nation. And it would
as demonstrated by their hateful comments about the English, I'm sure.
Well, those tours had to, you know, put, you know, the history of Scotland in its proper historical context against the tyranny of the English, of course.
We protected those people from themselves for hundreds of years, and this is the way they repay us.
But I mean, it would have been very, very odd and off-putting had we gone to Scotland and not seen proper civic displays of love for nation. We expected to see that. We, in a sense, you know, we wanted to see that. We were excited to go to Scotland. It would have seemed odd had none of the people there actually been excited about being in Scotland. And I think what we see in the U.S. is, you know, you mentioned it earlier that this preoccupation with self, a therapeutic preoccupation with self, can work against an appropriate sort of patriotism, because patriotism calls me to look outside of myself. It causes me to value others to the point of willing sacrifice if necessary. Why is it that Americans can watch certain films like Saving Private Ryan, where extraordinary acts of selfless sacrifice and heroism are displayed and our hearts are moved by that, as they should be? And we wonder, you know, is that still alive in our country or in any Western nation right now, is a willingness to sacrifice? You hear some of that, and whatever you think about Winston Churchill, I happen to admire the man, even with his faults. I go back and I read some of his speeches and think, you know, could some of those things even be said now, today? I look at some of Reagan's speeches or some of Eisenhower's speeches. And I think, could some of those things even be said today, or would they be seen as kind of retrograde or even ironic because of the sort of sacrifice they call for, because of the sort of looking outside of oneself that they call for? You know, you look at U.S. Navy or U.S. Army recruiting materials now, and what is the slogan of the U.S. Army now? Be an army of one. You know, it's what they've done is they've tapped into the self-centered therapeutic culture quite well, actually, and said that the military service is really about you. It's about you becoming you.
And that was clear with the campaign for transgender service people, and the idea that we have to allow transgender people to express themselves through the army. Well, the whole point of the army was not was you don't express yourself.
You're not there to express yourself.
You lose your individuality in order to become a part of a fighting machine to defend the nation.
Exactly.
It's, you know, if you're not doing that, then you're not an army, you're a therapy group.
Right.
But cut to, let's bring it sort of close to home then for the church, Todd. And I have my opinion on this, but I'm not going to tell you until you put your foot in it. And I can then present myself as Mr. Reasonable to the, to the listeners. American flag in church. Yeah. What about it?
Yes. So here's the deal. I love to see the American flag in public spaces. I think the American flag ought to be in schools and in town squares and on our city streets. I think American flags ought to be in corporate headquarters, although even privately owned, they shouldn't be forced. But I think American corporations would be wise to have an American flag. I think American flags ought to adorn households. I love on the 4th of July to drive around my neighborhood and see American flags, and at Memorial Day to see American flags. I think that's a wonderful thing. Just like I would expect to see, as I said, the same thing in Scotland, to see Scottish flags waving. But I would not put an American flag in the place of Christian worship because, for a couple of reasons, but mostly because when we are inviting people into the sanctuary, into the place of the corporate worship of God on the Lord's Day, we are having them step into kind of a new sort of nation, if you like, whose king is the Lord. And though God is the king over all the world and over all nations, in that place of worship, we need to be very careful to be reminded that our citizenship ultimately is in heaven, that our king is Jesus, and that we are there to worship him. Another reason why I don't have an American flag in the worship center, in the sanctuary itself, but not in the church building at all, is because we want to say to anyone from wherever they are from who would show up at our front door that the Lord's house is a house for all the nations. Mm. If I was going to have an American flag, I'd want to have all of the flags. You know, I can see a place for that. I can see a place for a church having flags from all of the nations, and that being, you know, an appropriate reminder. But I would say either have all the flags or don't have any flags.
So you are a commie then, after all.
Oh yeah, I'm a liberal feminist communist.
It's interesting because as an immigrant, I have never been offended or intimidated by the American flag in a church. I don't find it offensive on that level. I've never felt I've felt excluded sometimes for various reasons, but not because the American flag is there. But my own instincts lean very much in your direction. I often wondered, you know, if I was called as a pastor to a church where there's an American flag at the front, would it be a hill that I would die on as pastor? Probably not in my first 5 years. You know, it wouldn't be a deal breaker, but it would be something I think I'd want to teach on and hopefully persuade the elders and the congregation that it's not necessary. I mean, my wife and I have always taken the view that we are guests in the United States. We're privileged to be here. When we go to sports events, for example, we stand and I take my hat off for the national anthem. I don't sing your national anthem. I think that would be treasonous, and I could be beheaded or something if it was recorded. No, but we don't sing the national anthem. That would be ridiculous. We don't pledge allegiance to the flag. But I have to say, though, just culturally, pledging allegiance to a flag is kind of weird anyway from an English perspective. But we've always...
And actually, it And actually, it's not an incredibly old practice. Even in the United States, it's fairly contemporary.
There are no old practices in the United States. It's not a very old country, man.
But even in comparison to the United States, the pledge is not that old.
But we've never done it for obvious reasons. But I've always stood respectfully because, unlike some immigrants that I see pontificating online and on TV, I'm actually grateful to be here. I'm thankful to be in the United States. I think the United States, for all of the problems in its history, it doesn't have any more problems than many other nations have. And there are many, many good things to commend it. And as I say, it's been very good to me and my family. But flag in church, it's not quite a matter indifferent to me. I don't like to see the flag at the front of the church, but it doesn't offend me at any great level. And I've never felt unwelcome as a non-American in a church because there's been a flag at the front. But
I would say it, and it's interesting hearing you say that, because I thought, well, you know, if I were to have walked into a worship service in Scotland or England, and there had been an English flag or a Scottish flag, I'm sitting here thinking, I don't even know. I mean, if I had even noticed it at all, it wouldn't have offended me. And I'd never thought about it. I wouldn't have thought, oh my goodness, they're expecting me to worship their nation too. That thought would never
have. We do have a different attitude to flags in Britain to America. There's much more of a cult of the flag here. Remember in the 1980s, you know, the Libyans were always burning the American and American flag, Stars and Stripes, and the Union Jack. And, you know, I remember sitting in British, we'd be sitting there scratching our heads thinking, oh, those crazy Libyans, what will they do next kind of thing? Whereas in America, that would be obviously a deeply offensive gesture. So I think the flag has less cachet. You'd probably see it in an Anglican church in England. But of course, the Anglican church is the established church. It's the church of the nation, which is, I also think, is a bit of a problem, actually. But we don't have the same cult of the flag.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier, don't try to do it in your first 5 years.
Don't try to do anything in your first 5 years unless you're dealing with absolute heresy. You don't have the goodwill to get away with it at that point.
That's right. If you are a young, idealistic pastor who, you know, is like me, hey, you love your country, you have a flag to put out in front on the 4th of July, but you do have a conviction about not having it in the sanctuary. Wow, there are a lot of other bigger priorities than you fixing that. And I've seen guys go in and ruin a lot of goodwill and cash in leadership stock that they haven't even built up yet to make that emotional of a move. And you're right. In the United States, the flag possesses a kind of sacredness that that other, you know, Western European nations may not have in terms of an attitude towards their flag. Now, I would also, how would you differentiate? So when we talk about Christian nationalism, I think about some of the unhealthy expressions of patriotism in the place of worship. I think of First Baptist Church, Dallas. Yeah. Who during the 2016 presidential campaign, their choir director, you know, the director of music there, wrote a choir anthem called "Make America Great Again." Yeah. I kid you not, and they performed it. That's clearly a problematic expression, I think, of patriotism in the place of worship, where we're starting to mix our allegiances there, starting to mix our worship of Jesus with our worship of our nation, and in some cases, perhaps even a particular candidate for president. And so we've seen those unhealthy expressions of patriotism. But to dismiss all attitudes or expressions of patriotism as inherently problematic or inherently parochial or inherently now more and more in some cases, you know, racist, is just, it doesn't make sense intellectually, but as I said earlier, I think you can make an argument against that in scripture, as well. I think there's an expectation among the biblical writers that there's going to be an attitude of proper loyalty to one's nation.
I think you're correct there, Todd. I think the, you know, I'd go to Augustinian categories here and say the the flourishing of the earthly city. And by earthly city, I don't mean urban ministry, you know, the urban area. I mean, the right. kingdoms of this earth, the flourishing of the nations right. that we belong to is important for the protecting of the innocent and the putting down of the wicked. Now, the nation state as we have it is a contingent historical construct. You go back 500 years, you would right. not find nation states in the way we have them today. It's always, you know, when you teach Reformation, I'm always wrestling with, how do we describe Luther? Do we call him a German nationalist at points? Well, we can't really, because there is no German nation there. You know, Luther's patriotism, if you like, is constructed a little differently to ours. But I think one thing you find throughout history is that the welfare of the earthly social structures, of which now the nation state is the most prominent, that's important for the protecting of the innocent and right. the putting down of the wicked. And to that extent, I think Christians have a vested interest in being patriotic, in promoting the good of the earthly city. It's when we start to confuse the earthly city with the heavenly city, when we start to think that, you know, America is vital to the coming of the kingdom. When we start thinking like that, then we're starting to move into the directions, I would say, of nationalism, and we're eliminating yeah. biblical thinking there and replacing it with something that is much more worldly in its orientation.
Well, you mentioned Luther, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but wouldn't you say that part of what drove Bonhoeffer was his love for Germany?
Yeah, yeah. And I think the love for the earthly city is most powerfully and best articulated in love for the weak, in love for the innocent, in love for putting down the wicked and protecting those people. And our nations are the units by which we do that at this particular point in time. And I think Bonhoeffer understood that. And I think Christians today should understand that. Yes, we should repudiate the truly nationalistic and racist kind of approaches to nationhood that sometimes do penetrate Christian circles. I mean, there's no doubt that Christians can be vulnerable to this sin as to any other sin. But that doesn't mean that we should replace or reject what is good in those things. And as I said, you know, we don't reject the family because some people idolize the family or some families are abusive. What we do is we project a good vision of the family. We reform the family. And I think we need to think about that relative to the Christian approach to the nation. It's not something that we idolatrously worship, because that's going to be a problem. But it's something that as Christians, we strive to make as good as possible, to fulfill the limited functions that it is designed to fulfill.
Yeah, that's good. And I think it's helpful, considering all of the confusion on the issue, where we see misplaced zeal, but also misplaced antipathy, and the truth is in between there somewhere. Well, we're glad you joined us today. If you're an American, be thankful for it. If you're English, be thankful for it. If you're Scottish, be especially thankful.
And Canadians,
for it.
Be thankful for it. We need to, you know, after that racist comment earlier on, Canadians, be thankful for Canada.
Yeah. Right. Love your country. You can be a faithful, God-honoring Christian. In fact, I think part of being a faithful, God-honoring Christian is loving the place where God has placed you, loving those people in your immediate vicinity, and caring for the good of your nation, and loving your place on the earth where the Lord has in his providence placed you. And there's proper expressions for that. Well, if you go to our website, mortificationofspin.org, we have a few copies of a new book by Oz Guinness. Many of you know or are familiar with Oz Guinness. He's a resident of the United States. In fact, I think he is actually a citizen of the United States, but from the United Kingdom, and he's quite a prolific writer. And his last couple of books have centered around the issue of his concern about the loss of American distinctives of liberty and freedom. And as someone who was born and raised in a different place, it has clearly troubled him to see an antipathy among Americans for the unique liberties that we have. Now, his latest book is called The Magna Carta of Humanity, Sinai's Revolutionary Faith and the Future of Freedom. I've been reading it. I'm almost done with it. And I've really been helped by it. I think there's some excellent insight into this that would be helpful and encouraging for Americans to read and to perhaps gain a sort of biblical grounding for a proper sort of love for one's country. But if you'll go to our website, you can register to win a copy of Mr. Guinness's newest book, The Magna Carta of Humanity. And while you're there, you might want to consider making a donation to the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals so that they can continue to provide you with content like this. And until then, we'll look forward to being with you once again on Mortification of Spin.
Thanks for listening to Mortification of Spin, a podcast of the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. For more on topics like this, visit mortificationofspin.org, where you can find other articles by Carl and Todd, browse the archive of past episodes, and make a donation. We'll talk to you next time on Mortification of Spin. University and seminary credentials are not the end, but only steps in a lifelong calling to theological wisdom. And theological wisdom is greatly needed today. Greystone Theological Institute exists to resource rigorous and effective continuing education and scholarship by hosting full and micro-course modules, study days, seminars, workshops, and other events designed for advanced theological edification and fellowship. Exploring and deploying advances in scholarship across the disciplines, Greystone sharpens skills, provokes new questions, and reconsiders old ones in the mode of confessional Reformed Catholicity. Join the next course or event at Greystone in Pittsburgh or online, or become a Greystone member at greystoneconnect.org today and enjoy access to the rapidly growing online library of all modules, events, and seminars for the price of a paperback. Greystone Theological Institute. Faithful theological wisdom, edification, and training in a rapidly changing world. Visit greystoneinstitute.org for more about Greystone and greystoneconnect.org to become a member today.